Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On today's show, we picked up a drunken-looking revenge thriller, but when we got it home, it turned out to be something else entirely. An awards contender. That's right, today we are reviewing Promising Young Woman. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really happy to be with the Malcolm and Marie fan club tonight.
And listeners will be delighted to know that tonight's episode is Not All Men, because on today's episode we are welcoming a very promising young woman. It's film and TV journalist Emily Murray. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on to discuss this film. Now, we're going to be looking at a film which, as of just a few days ago, gained Golden Globe nominations for Best Actress for Carey Mulligan, Best Picture Drama, and Best Screenplay and Director for Emerald Fennell. Now, Emerald Fennell is, at the moment, probably best known for playing Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown and for writing the second season of Killing Eve. Now, fun fact for everyone, question for you, who is the odd one out? Is it Dallas, Lee, Emily, or the cast and crew of Killing Eve? Anyone want to take a hazard a guess?
You've got me curious here. I have no idea.
I don't know.
Well, despite what they might have said in season 3 of Killing Eve, neither the cast and crew of Killing Eve have not been to Aberdeen, whereas all three of us actually have. There is a connection there, isn't there?
Yeah, I never clicked with that one. I think very few people ended up watching Killing Eve season 3, so yeah, this is like a deep cut for like the 3 viewers that have continued to stay with the show.
Yeah, it was like quite a shock when the Aberdeen was splashed across the screen in giant talk, and then it was like, that's not Aberdeen. That's not Aberdeen train station. It was just really I was like, did I miss them filming in here? How could I have missed that? But yeah, no, sadly not. But all of us at one point or another have spent time in Aberdeen. So it's quite odd that we've all managed to come together for this particular film. Now, the film is getting a lot of buzz and we're going to dive into the nitty-gritty soon. But Emily, I'm going to come to you first. When did you first see the film? What were your expectations and did the film live up to them?
The PR sent me a screener like early January, I think. Obviously, this was when the film was meant to be out in early Feb. It's obviously it's been delayed now. And I'd seen obviously that it had rave reviews from America, because I think it's out in America, right? It came out over Christmas.
Yeah, it's been out. But came out in America on sort of like, yeah, they came out on Christmas and then I think they had a 3-week window and then it's been on sort of VOD rental from sort of like mid-January. So kind of nearly a month now out there.
Yeah, and yeah, so I was really excited to see it. It looked like it was up my street. Killing Eve season 2 is my favourite season of Killing Eve. And I hadn't seen her in The Crown because I don't watch The Crown, but and it just blew my socks off, to be honest. Like, I think it's an extraordinary movie. It's definitely one of the best things I've seen for a long time. So I'm very much, I understand some people don't, you know, they weren't too impressed, but I'm very much in the pro camp, pro Promising Young Woman camp.
Excellent. Lee, when did you first see the film?
It's been a long, long road. I remembered sort of watching the trailer when that first dropped. Was that like maybe even 2018, as far back as that? I remember watching it kind of heading back home from work one day, like really cold in the street, had it out on my phone. I was like, I really want to see that film. Like the use of Britney Spears is toxic. I love Carey Mulligan, sort of like the neon pop colors. Like I immediately thought, this is a film I'm really looking forward to. And I think none of us expected it to be the surprise movie at Glasgow Film Festival, and usually I would go along to it, but I chose not to for some bizarre reason last year. I didn't. And yeah, I was absolutely gutted when I found out that you and many of our friends got to get the chance to see it. But I thought to myself, you know what, don't worry about it, Lee. You'll see it in like 2 months' time. It's not a big long wait for something like that. And then ultimately I had to wait another sort of, you know, just shy of another year to watch it. So I was lucky enough to get a BAFTA screener for it. And yeah, I wish I could have watched that one in the cinema with an audience. That would have been, it was such a great experience. And I'm hopeful that can still be the case for some people, perhaps in the UK in good time. But yeah, I was really, really impressed with it. And I've been excited to talk about it since.
Well, I've had to wait even longer than you to talk about it, because I was lucky enough to see it at the Glasgow Film Festival. I can't remember what we thought it was going to be, but we didn't think it was going to be that. But when it did come up, I was very excited. And yeah, it lived up to my expectations. I mean, it was just sort of straight out of the gate. The opening shot, where it's basically filming men's groins dancing in slow motion in a club, in pretty much exactly the same way that a Fast and Furious film would film women dancing in a club. So I thought, okay, this director, she means business. This is not going to be what you think. It's going to subvert expectations, and I'm absolutely here for it. So, I mean, we can sort of dive straight into one of the first discussion topics, which is the first scene with Adam Brody is a guy who's at the club with a couple of his mates and spies Carey Mulligan, who's rather worse for wear, and tries to do the nice guy thing to give her a lift home, and then on the way decides to take her back to his for a drink, and then basically one thing leads to another, and he tries it on when she's not in the right frame of mind to do it, only for the tables to be turned and for her to actually know exactly what's going on. And then she confronts him, and then smash cut to black. And I mean, I guess with the trailer and stuff, it's kind of obvious where the film's going to go, that she is doing this. But I can imagine that, especially at the Glasgow Film Festival, it's a surprise film. A cold open like that really could have been quite shocking for people. So Emily, let's come to you first. What did you make of the initial scene and setting the tone for the film?
I think it's what you said. It's like, I think the trailers misrepresent the film quite a lot, actually, because I think it paints it as a straight revenge thriller, and to me it's not at all, which we can obviously talk about later. But I think from the opening scene, about seeing her interaction with the guy, like, and I don't know, like, when it's not spoilers, I don't think, but when she comes out and she's covered in red sauce, you realise it's ketchup, but actually you think, oh, is that blood? And then you're like, oh no, like, he's still alive. And you sort of realise that it's not going to be the straight revenge filler that you might have expected. And it just, I don't know, from that, yeah, from the initial like 10 minutes, I knew I was completely sold on the film. It just continued to subvert my expectations even more, which is why I think it's so brilliant, to be honest.
And Lee, what did you make of the opening scene?
Yeah, I'm going to be a bit of a broken record with probably a lot of the points ahead for this movie. I thought it subverted expectations incredibly well. And I came away thinking, like, it's one of those things, like, I always think back to my sort of maybe younger student days, and you think of like nightclub photos and what you probably thought you looked really like shit hot, like the coolest people around. And then sort of like when a camera captures you, you just look like a bunch of losers and idiots. And I just thought immediately kind of takes you in, sort of like you think everything's looking really good. It's going to be very polished. And it's just that, yeah, these people are losers. And even sort of like using kind of Adam Brody early on and probably with a lot of the other actors in this, you have that expectation that, oh, this is like your typical rom-com guy, really good looking white guy with slick, you know, nice kind of scruffy hair, you know, the sort of person that you'd maybe take home to mom, kind of playing on sort of your, you know, the typical audience that might go see this, that has kind of flashbacks to him. I think, what was it, The OC or something, where he was a bit of a dream boy and so on. So it's immediately kind of playing with a lot of different expectations that you might have had beyond even the trailer going in.
And you know, once she's at home, you know, she's got this notebook, which is sort of sealed shut with a hairband of her friend Nina. And one thing which has never, I don't think, been answered, but I've always got questions of, is you know, clearly she has done what she does several times. There's a lot of marks in her book, but there's different colours. Does anyone have any theories as to what the colours meant? I think there was a black, she used black pen, blue pen, red pen. Did it? Do you think it was just how far things went with the men before she turned the tables, or?
I think she's probably just making it like obviously aesthetics, like in this movie, is really important in terms of the use of costumes and makeups, and it's very bright and it's very colourful. So like if I had a book and I was, you know, making note of stuff like that, I'd probably just use different coloured pens randomly as well.
Yeah, I always think of like the women I work with, and you know, whether it's been at work or school, I've always been like blue or black pens and so on. Whereas like my kind of friends have always had like the bright coloured pens. They maybe mix things up a little bit. You know, I think there's an interesting kind of way about how sort of like people choose to learn. And you know, I think that could be an element that sort of ties into kind of believability there, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it fits with the, I think it fits with the colourful aesthetic of the movie.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if anyone else at school had one of those pens that had about 10 different coloured ink things in it. You sort of would rotate it and then yes, you'd have the different things.
Of course.
I just had that image just sort of popped into. but sort of going down the line, you know, we learn a bit more about Cassie, and, you know, she's still living with her parents. She's clearly not over an incident which has happened with her best friend Nina, which happened at college. She's dropped out of medical school, but it's not until sort of one of the later scenes with McLovin himself, Christopher Mintz-Platt, where you realize that, okay, she's not actually harming these people, she's not hurting them or anyway, she's just basically turning the tables on them and basically showing them just what an utter sort of low life they actually are. And, you know, with the non-violent approach, was that surprising to people? Sort of, I think, Emily, like you said, the trailers made it out to make it more, look more like of your standard revenge thriller. Were you surprised when it turned out that she wasn't actually sort of physically hurting them, but just basically showing them for what they were?
I was delighted, to be honest, that it wasn't violent, because I'm sick and tired of sort of seeing those really violent revenge thriller types, if that makes sense, which I think is why this is so refreshing. Because I think the thing that gets me about this movie is it's so realistic. Like, I can see, like, all of it happening. Obviously, it's still, like, a film, but I don't know, like, and I don't think Cassie's a good person at all. I think the film makes it quite obvious that what she's doing isn't great. Like, to me, it's not really a revenge thriller. It's more just like a portrayal of grief, because she's grieving and her response is this. And there's a really crucial scene, you know, with Nina's mum, where it's like, you shouldn't really be doing this. And I think it's really important that the film's message is like, yeah, I don't think like what she's doing, even if she is bringing attention to this issue, like, it's still not the right way to go about it, even though it is non-violent as well.
I mean, I was, before going into the film, even up until a few weeks ago, because I kind of, you know, even though I knew people had seen it, I didn't want to hear about it. I didn't want to read any people's reviews. I kind of caught it a few weeks after it sort of began its rollout in America. Like, if someone asked me to place this film in a genre, I would have had it in amongst your Auditions, Love Witch, Revenge, Dragon Tattoos, Lady Vengeance, Hard Candy. Like, that's what I was predisposed to think was this film was going to be, even at the beginning. I kind of had to go back and, I suppose, the one benefit of sometimes watching these things at home, like, when she sort of started making the note in the book with another dash, I thought, did she kill that guy? I didn't think she did. But, like, even at that moment where I knew that wasn't what was happening, my brain was telling me, no, I've missed something here. I need to go back and review it again. It was, and I just love that about the film, is once again, my expectations, even when I'm watching the film and seeing what's happening in front of me, I'm not accepting of it.
Yeah, and I think I've just made a note to come back to it later on in the episode about when potentially, you know, she does move on from what she's doing, but we'll circle back to that. But I mean, you know, a lot of the film's success is down to this incredibly complex character of Cassie and sort of Carey Mulligan's performance in it. I mean, she's a fantastic actress anyway, but were either of you sort of surprised by the sort of depths that she managed to go down to in this one? Lee, I'm going to come to you first on it.
No, I really like Carey Mulligan, and I think of some of the films over the past few years that have really stood out for me, things like Shame, Wildfire. I think she's a fantastic actress that I would love to see more of her in. So yeah, like when you kind of think again of these sorts of revenge movies, you know, a woman gets revenge, a lot of the time it's that young woman, teenager, you know, maybe in their sort of early 20s. I liked that it was someone that was that little bit older, and you know, I thought that was a really interesting choice, and you know, Carey Mulligan completely sold it to me. I know there was some kind of discourse and debate about sort of, you know, was she the right person for the role. I found it impossible not to watch the film and think that she wasn't perfectly cast.
Yeah. Emily, what did you make of her performance?
Yeah, I mean, I've always likely been a fan of Carey Mulligan, and I think she's just perfect in this role. Like to me, it's like, and this is why I find it so weird about trying to put Promising Young Women into a genre, because it's so many genres, but the way I describe it is it's a character study of is she meant to be like late 20s, right, sort of like round then, but it's a character study of, you know, a young woman in grief and trying to, you know, cope with that grief. And I think Carey Mulligan really like taps into, you know, the complexities of her character, and you really do care for her, even though you disagree with some of her actions. Like, I still want things to go well for her, if that makes sense.
Oh no, absolutely. And one of the things which potentially could turn her life around to make things nicer for her is the introduction of A Blast from Her Past, in the form of Bo Burnham, who used to go to medical school with her. He comes into the coffee shop where she works, and for me, probably the hottest scene, meet-cute of the year. I mean, for some reason, I found it incredibly sexy, the whole sort of spitting in the coffee and then him drinking it and stuff like that. I don't know why. Maybe that's a fetish I've suddenly developed. I don't know. But, I mean, I thought Bo Burnham is great. He's another sort of actor who's sort of almost sort of playing against type in the fact that he's, you know, basically known for sort of stand-up comedy at this point. But I thought he made for a really engaging sort of romantic lead in this one. Emily, what did you make of Bo Burnham in this one?
See, I'm not sure how spoilery we get in. I need to ask this before.
There will be a spoiler break later on in the episode where we can get into the ending and I guess the ending for several characters on the thing. But on first appearances, what did you make of Bo Burnham's character?
To be honest, I didn't really... He was cute, and it was... The pharmacy scene is fantastic because it's just so much fun, because this is my thing about Promising Young Women is it's like, obviously, the way it addresses sexual assault and feminism and stuff, like that's all very, very important, but also it's just a fun movie to watch. It's enthralling, it's funny, and I think you need that sort of light relief with, it's Ryan, the character's called Ryan, isn't it, with Ryan. And you know, like that scene of like the rom-com montage in the pharmacy, they're singing Paris Hilton, and it has a montage scene of, you know, them falling in love. Like, it is just warming, and you know, you're sort of hoping that Cassie would have found the happiness that, you know, that she's sort of been wanting. And you I think you need that light relief in such a heavy movie. It is heavy in terms of topics, but I also didn't trust Bo Burnham from the off, to be honest, because I don't know, I think it's just the way the film's narrative was going, and there was just sort of an edge to him. Like, there's no, like, I think the message of the film was so far was there's no such thing as a nice guy, and I thought it would have been, I don't know, I just sort of expected a turn, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess it was potentially sort of going down the route of not all men, but then potentially,
yeah,
when we get to the spoiler things, it might turn out that yes, it is all men. Lee, I know you're a Bo Burnham fan from eighth grade. What did you make of his leading man role in this one?
Yeah, I really still need to get around to watching his kind of stand-up material. But, you know, my expectation of sort of Bo Burnham was that he is someone that is this a really good comedian, but I know him as this fantastic writer-director from 8th grade, and kind of him sort of doing the publicity circuit for that. And you know, one of the things that would make me think of, and I'm reminded of someone that featured in one of sort of Emily's Christopher Nolan podcasts, is someone like that Robin Williams. I love when you get a comedian cast in something like this, where they have that, you're like, this person is, they're funny, but there's that little edge to them. And there's just something about him where he is just really awkward, and just
the
way he carries his quite lanky body. He's very dispassionate in a way, and so on like that. He's just, he's always present, but there's just something about him. And I always kind of think of where sorry, the NHS, but I always think of something like that where, you know, you hear about where to be someone that is the top of their field, you know, whether that's in banking, business, or even being someone that's a professional doctor and so on, you know, to achieve that goal is something that takes, you know, single focus, determination, you know, putting, you know, personal feelings aside to achieve that. And there's just something about it where you kind of just think, right, where is this going to go with this guy, even to the bitter end, you know? And I just thought he was really cast. I can never tire of someone like that. And he's got like the dreamy good looks again, you know. This is a tall guy, you know, real nice brown hair, perfect skin, makes people laugh. And I always think of that line people used with Eighth Grade, where it was like, no one understands teenage girls better than Bo Burnham. And there's just an element to that of like, okay, interesting. I think there's an element where he can play to that. So yeah, a really great introduction to Bo Burnham in this kind of leading role.
Yeah, he's great. And I don't know, for me, I think there's a scene where, like, early on where he's like, oops, look where we are. Oh, it's my apartment. And I think that, to me, was the sort of edge of his character that sort of sent, like, red flags going in my brain. And I think it's, yeah, like, and he was awkward and he was apologetic about it. But I don't know, it's just, I think Bo Burnham did such a great job of, capturing sort of, he's lovely, but also there's something going on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, that was what sort of that was a really sort of important scene, I think, in the relationship, where, you know, she's potentially liking someone, but then she goes along and then she thinks that, okay, he's just after the same thing as everyone else is, and then she calls it off for the first time, but then decides to give him another go. And, you know, we get that wonderful scene that you say with, I mean, who knew that Stars Are Blind by Paris Hilton would have been the song of 2020?
I've never heard that song before either. So thanks, Promising Young Woman.
Lee, was that a regular on your Spotify list before the film? Or
No, not before the film, but it's safe to say I'm slightly terrified about what my Spotify Wrapped is going to be at the end of the year. It has been really played quite a lot.
So, I mean, I want to sort of briefly sort of talk about the soundtrack, I think, because everything else from here on will pretty much be talking spoilers. So before we do that, what did you guys make of the soundtrack, which is, for me, one of the best soundtracks of the year, actually all of last year, actually, because I've been listening to it since then. I mean, you've got that incredible sort of string version of Toxic. You've got the use of things like It's Raining Men at the beginning, where she's sort of walking along and stuff like this, you know, I think. And then I'm just going to say a wonderful deployment of the song Angel of the Morning, and I'll leave it at that. But what did you guys make of the soundtrack overall?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like, the soundtrack itself, like, you can find it online, etc. It's good. It's got most of the tracks, but I think you'd have to definitely seek out sort of those kind of the playlists that really compile the, you know, the countless songs that are featured in it. And yeah, and it's one of those ones, like, you think of something that's got like Spice Girls in it, Raining Men, you know, Paris Hilton, etc. You know, it's all very kind of light, and it's one of those things you can almost have this preconception that, oh, this is just like one of those kind of neon, slightly ironic uses of songs. But I never came away from the film at all thinking, oh, that's such an ironic use of Paris Hilton. I was like, oh, that is a fantastic choice for that. Or even, you know, Raining Men, To Become One, it all lends itself well, and it kind of plays on some of those preconceptions that we have about those songs. So yeah, really, really good playlist.
Yeah, I agree with Lee. I think, you know, seeing Emerald Fennell does really well. It's the same with the costumes. Is, you know, this is a young woman who, like, she's probably around my age, and she probably grew up listening to Britney Spears. Although I never listened to Paris Hilton, but probably if you're in America, like, you probably listen to Paris Hilton. And so, you know, if this is Cassie's story, this is Cassie's character study, you would use the music that she'd listen to. And I think in feminism, there's something like, I think there's sort of this image of feminism that we should rally against, like all this sort of like poppy music about boys and, you know, these pop anthems that are super girly, and we shouldn't be wearing all this makeup and we shouldn't be having fun with our outfits. And I don't really know why that's the case, but I think there is that perception amongst some people. So I like that this film is like, no, like, actually, we should be, you know, like, absorbing ourselves in this culture and sort of just embracing it and loving it. So I like that it's done that with the makeup, the costumes and the soundtrack. I think it all just works perfectly. And it feels real. Like, this is the music Cassie would wear. This is the music Cassie would listen to. This is the outfits Cassie would wear. And it just feels real to me. She feels like a real human.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's probably slightly off topic. It would take too long to get into on the podcast, but I'm sure there's probably essays and dissertations being done on the fact that Stars Are Blind is done by Paris Hilton, a woman who basically made that song after becoming famous for appearing in a sex tape, which originally she was going to be exploited by, but then she managed to basically turn it around and turn it to her advantage. And it sort of leads us into basically the main part of the film where we can talk spoilers. So if you have not yet seen Promising Young Woman, please press pause, go away, watch this incredible film, come back. Have you seen it? Okay, good. So basically the film is called Promising Young Woman, which in itself is a play on the fact that apparently Brock Turner, in a very famous case in America, was basically let off raping a girl because apparently he was a really good swimmer and, what as they dubbed him, a promising young man who didn't deserve to go to jail. So that's where the title came from. And it's all about the fact that Cassie's friend Nina was basically taken advantage of at a party at college, and she got a reputation, and then that led her to become seriously really depressed, dropped out, and eventually killed herself. And then Cassie is long been harboring these feelings and has been, you know, going out with men and teaching them a lesson. But when she meets Ryan and discovers that he's still Facebook friends with the person responsible, she puts together this plan, which she's had for, I think, quite a long time, in four parts, where she sort of tries to destroy the lives of the four people who were responsible. A female friend from school who did nothing, the dean of the college where she dropped out, and that's, she just basically making her think that her daughter's going through something similar. But then it also starts to fall apart when she visits the lawyer played by Alfred Molina, who sort of breaks down and reveals that he's actually been tortured by what he did to the girls, which is basically making sure that no one would believe their story, that, you know, she wasn't asking for it, by sort of going through social media and sort of finding testimonies from other people that she was drunk. There was no way she could just say yes or no, and basically casting doubt on these people. And at that point, after seeing this guy's guilt, she does kind of drop out of it. And this is where she sort of starts to go out with Ryan. But then when the video surfaces, this basically kicks in the final stage of her plan, where she goes to the guy's bachelor party. So before we get to the bachelor party, what did everyone make of Cassie's plan on getting revenge, and do you think it was justified?
What I thought, for me, about the plan, that I thought was all excellent. Something we've kind of touched on, and this is that not all men, all men. I think what it did so well was that it showed how deep rape culture kind of goes and how many people enable it to be successful, really. When we kind of see with the dean, the friends, you know, people that have been conditioned to accept these things, you know, I find that really, really interesting, because, you know, if we are to remove it from sort of society, we all need to look at the role some of us have played in it. And, you know, I always think of something a close friend of mine told me, where she was like, the statistics for women that have been involved in some kind of sexual assault or issue is incredibly high. But yet it is nearly every man will turn around and say, oh, I have never heard of it. I wouldn't know anyone that has done that. And it's one of those things, like, I never put the two and two together about this, the promising young man aspect. But for someone like that to get away with it, there has to be a complete culture of that enables something like that to happen, or is accepting of it, or has been conditioned to, you know, boys will be boys almost, something like that. So I found that really interesting, the scope and scale that her plan, you know, kind of involved. And it wasn't just Zero focused in on, as we'd probably maybe expect in sort of, you know, some of these movies where it's like, here's four people, whether they're guys or a group, whatever, that they've done wrong and the revenge will be taken out on them. She is looking to bring down an entire system to teach people lessons. And it's not about killing people or getting them. It's about making people think, realize their complicity and sort of reflect on sort of their severe damage that they've done to her friend.
Yeah, I agree. It's for me, actually, some of the most important characters is Alison Brie as Madison and the Dean of the University, as you said, because like as you said, it's rape culture. It's not just men, it's women as well. Like the amount of times I've like stuff's happened to friends and it's been like other women who've said, well, you were drunk that night, or look at what you were wearing. And, you know, I've had that said to me as well. Like, did you not see the dress you were going out in, Emily? And it's like, why does the blame go, it's not just the fact that it's like a promising young man, it's like, but also why does the blame turn around on a woman in that situation? I think that's something Promising Young Woman really nails, that, you know, that's wrong. And that's why it's important to have this Madison character, because she, you know, she just sort of threw it off as like, that's what happens if you go around sleeping with guys every single night at university, which is like completely the wrong thing to say, because I think that's how a lot of these situations are, you know, like people use excuses for them as the girl was just drunk. And that to me was like quite hard hitting, because I've not really seen that before in a movie, especially one which I suppose is labeled like a revenge thriller. And even though I don't think Cassie's actions were completely right, like when she goes to Dean, she pretends that she's kind of like kidnapped her daughter. You know, that's like, it's not a great move, but I also totally get why she was doing that and what she was doing, even though I disagreed with how she was doing it. But I don't think the film's meant to make you like, she's not a heroine, if you know what I mean. She's not a hero at all.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when you get those lines from sort of the argument with Cassie and Madison, you know, it's one of the most relatable aspects of the movie, where they're talking about if you have a reputation for sleeping around, then maybe people aren't going to believe you when you say something's happened, crying wolf, you know, not making the rules, when you get that drunk, things happen. You don't get blacked out drunk all the time, expect people to be on your side. And when you have sex with someone you don't want to, we've all heard those arguments, whether it was, you know, friends, you know, people justifying their behavior, you know, even sort of like politicians. You certainly have to look at sort of the last Betsy DeVos, the education secretary under Trump, you know, was using those kind of arguments and so on. And it's amazing, you know, again, it's not just men that use it. It is like an entire system, whether it's political, educational, like these arguments are ingrained in society in such a negative and toxic way.
Yeah, and I think that's why this film stands out to me, because of that, you know, the way it addresses that. Like I said, Alison Brie's character, Madison, and Nadine, like those characters are, I think, play a more pivotal role in the film's message compared to the men itself. It's not just men, it's women who are part of this culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's the scene with the dean where it's like, you know, she's saying, oh, we can't, you know, ruin a guy's life just based on, you know, something one person said. And it's like, you know, this whole sort of he said, she said argument and stuff is crazy that these people aren't believed. And Alfred Molina sort of saying that, and this is probably something that she's actually talked to, Emerald Fennell probably talked to lawyers and stuff about receiving a bonus for every, you know, conviction that, you know, they can quash and stuff like that based on all these things. But there's been a lot of movies sort of recently. There was an A24 film called Cher about a young girl who goes to a party, gets drunk, and then wakes up the next day to find out that there was a video taken of her and she can't remember what happened and she tries to find out. There was a documentary on Netflix a couple of years ago, Roll Red Roll, about a documentary about a high school rape, and it was basically put together from sort of phone calls, testimonies, social media posts and stuff like that. And it's really interesting how, you know, this sort of social media aspect and stuff and video things are changing things. You know, videos can be used and sort of cameras can be used for really interesting ways, like certainly with like the Black Lives Matter and stuff. Some people are now seeing a phone as an item of protection, you know, against the cops and stuff like that. But in you know, other people can use sort of phones and stuff as weapons as well, I think. And, you know, it raises a lot of questions. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about the film is I don't think it's probably impossible not to come out of this film and not, you know, want to talk about it and even sort of even question your own opinions and sort of things. You'd even sort of look back at your own life and go, okay, well, was I ever, you know, maybe I said something or, you know, perhaps, you know, things that, like you say, when you're at college and stuff like that, which seem innocuous at the time, you actually don't realise that actually they would have had an effect on people, something you said or something like that. So I think it's a conversation starter, and I think it's a really important film that is coming out now. And it's interesting that I wonder if it had come out when it should have, like April last year, if it would have had the same impact on the awards race, if it would have been able to maintain that momentum. I mean, the last time a film that came out like April, May time and managed to do well at the Oscars, I think, was Mad Max Fury Road, which was ace. So the aforementioned video, which, you know, Cassie is shown by Madison, we then get the gut punch when we hear of a familiar voice on the video, and it turns out that Bo Burnham's Ryan was at the party and did nothing to prevent the situation. And, you know, this leads to a confrontation between the two, and she essentially blackmails him into giving her the address of the guy's bachelor party, which she then attends, which includes Schmidt from New York. And basically, she basically drugs a bottle of vodka, makes sure everyone else passes out, handcuffs the rapist to the bed in order to give him a lap dance as a stripper, only to then try to basically enact her final revenge, which is not to kill him, but to carve Nina's name onto his chest so that he would never ever forget what he did. And major spoilers, it doesn't work out like that, and unfortunately Cassie is smothered to death. And this is probably one of the biggest bones of contention I've seen with people talking about it. But I know that Emerald Fennell said in an interview that basically it was the only way it could have gone, because realistically a girl like Cassie would not have been able to overpower a man, and she wanted to make it kind of realistic. But I know that in the world of Hollywood, the ending probably would have gone a different way. What did you guys make of the confrontation with Bo Burnham at the end, and then the decision for Cassie to lose her life?
Emily, that's, yeah, I was going to say I'm with Emerald. That was the only way it could have gone. The Bo Burnham thing, like I said, there was an edge to him, so I saw that he would be a bad person. I didn't expect a video, though, so that still had shock value for me. I think also it's important to note that we never see the video ourselves, and we never see the rape. And I think that's really crucial, because in other movies, you probably would have that rape scene, or you would get a glimpse of the video. It's just unnecessary in this story. It's just unnecessary in a lot of stories, but, you know, in this one as well, like, we can figure out, you know, what's going on and how horrible it is anyways. But I think, yeah, like, Bo Burnham's character, Ryan, is just an asshole, like, clearly. Like, not only did he watch this girl get raped and do nothing about it, but I think it's the second part as well, where after Cassie's death, like, she's died, I think the police go to him and say, like, when was the last time you saw her? Do you know where she was going? And he lies to them. You know, he knew that she'd be going to the bachelor party, but he lies. And that was like, I can't see Bo Burnham as a nice guy ever again. Like, after that scene, I think that's really, like, Bo Burnham is ruined for me now. I'm sorry. Sorry, Bo. But I think that was like a double punch, if you know what I mean. Like, it was just, he's already, like, witnessed his rape and did nothing, but now he's, like, covering for Al as well. He's not even telling the police the truth. But then, yeah, when she died, like, that really shocked me. But I do think, like, this film, it's what I said earlier, like, it's really realistic. It feels real. And it is the only way it could have gone. Like, I was reading an article earlier, actually, which said, you know, there's loads of comedies out there about bachelor parties where it's like, oh no, they killed the stripper, and it's like a joke. And I think that was a interesting way to subvert that genre as well in that one moment. Obviously, like, the film still I suppose, kind of has a... It doesn't have a happy ending, but, you know, Al goes to jail, and I think that's important, so it doesn't just end in, like, a downbeat. But I think as soon as she went to that house, like, she knew she was going to die as well. I don't think it crossed her mind that she'd be able to do this, but I think that was the only way she could find happiness as well. Like, she'd completed her mission in a way, and, you know, her story was kind of over, but it's really impacting. Like, it really surprised me, but, like, I think it's a perfect ending.
Yeah, I a lot of the words that you're saying there, you know, draw to mind the parallel I made, that she essentially goes on a suicide mission.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things, like, when I was watching her kind of, you know, suffocation scene, I was like, even until, like, again, similar to earlier on in the film, like, she's dead. I can see that she's dead. She's definitely dead. But, like, she's going to kick, isn't she? She's going to have a little jerk or something. And it doesn't happen. And I find that shocking to witness. But the reality is, when you kind of look at the statistics, and I don't have them to hand, but, you know, I'm sure they're easy to find, whereas, like, the amount, and we'll see it just now with lockdown, the amount of domestic abuse, women that die, you know, at the hands of men, you know, and it's people that they know or partners or in relationships, is staggering. It's genuinely shocking. And if you're being true to the film and its message, you kind of probably have to do something like this. You know, she essentially martyrs herself. You know, all of these people are going to suffer, are going to be exposed, you know. And what makes me kind of potentially a bit sad is that I can picture the end of this movie happening. They all go away to jail. Angel in the Morning, they got what they deserved. Even Bo Burnham, he had the chance right until the end to do the right thing, and he didn't. But I can almost imagine, like, an epilogue where it's like, they all go to jail, it's all shocked, you know, people are having conversations. Did you see what happened to that young woman? You know, what about those guys? Terrible. And then it gets forgotten about, and she just becomes another statistic, and they just become another group of men that are just numbers of men that sort of commit that kind of crime or atrocity against women. And then, you know, there will be more promising young women, promising young 2, 3, 4, 5, all within a few days. And it's almost one of those ones as she takes out these people, but I sadly fear that her kind of larger mission will fall short.
Yeah. It's her only purpose, though, in that she sees in her life is this mission. Like, that, you know, she still lives with her parents, and she's just got a crappy coffee job. And I also, by the way, I want to say Laverne Cox is fantastic, and perhaps the only good person in this movie, in terms of, like, that's actually, you are a good person, Laverne Cox. Maybe that's because we don't see the skeletons in her closet. But, you know, I think, like, Cassie's purpose was getting this, you know, revenge, I suppose, and justice. And so, yeah, I think, you know, she went knowing that she'd die, and then that would be her journey and purpose complete, which is really sad. Like, I think, like, that's why I don't think she's a heroine at all. I think she's just, like, quite a tragic character who's just, this is her way of coping with grief, and it's devastating.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that sort of her arc sort of towards the end, I mean, part of her essentially died when her friend Nina died, and she'd never gotten over that moment. And I think, yeah, the fact that she sent, you know, all this stuff to the lawyer indicates that, yeah, you know, she thought that there was a high probability that this was not going to end well. So, you know, she did make sure that, you know, she would get a victory in some form or another. And I was reading that apparently Emerald Fennell had asked someone how long it takes to smother someone, and apparently they said it would take about 2.5 minutes, and apparently it is 2.5 minutes in the movie, that scene of her actually struggling and stuff like that, which is probably the reason why it's so hard to watch. And like the thing with the sort of, oh my god, he killed the stripper sort of thing in the morning, I mean, the film I think it immediately brought to mind was, I think it was Peter Berg's Very Bad Things, like where you say it's played off as a joke, as, ah, you know, this woman was disposable and she's only basically set off this plot of this thing. And, you know, it hammers at home that, you know, that it's a real person here. And in terms of like the ending where, you know, the groom and stuff is arrested, do you think Bo Burnham's character got comeuppance? Do you think she sent the video to, like, everyone in his mailbox or something? Because I was half expecting the video to sort of pop up on other people's phones, but it sort of held off on that. I mean, do you think, you know, she decided it was punishment enough to to live with the fact that, you know, he was essentially responsible for her death as well, in the fact that he gave her the address to send her off there.
I almost get the feeling that probably that video only maybe made it to the lawyer or, you know, one other person, because I think she wouldn't... I can imagine, like, in the wrong hands, that could be something considered, you know, revenge porn, etc. You know, like, it's something where only a small group have seen it and experienced it, and I don't think she'd probably want her friend's last thing to be all these people maybe seeing her kind of sexually assaulted like that. You know, it's a stronger memory or sort of impact that, you know, revenge and justice has been done more than revenge in a way. So yeah, I think maybe it would only have gone to one person, you know, that would have been held in sort of confidential, you know, ways and so on, and it wouldn't have been a kind of mass kind of media thing, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Cassie would have known it would have been like inappropriate to sort of send that, and I don't think she's cruel either. Like, even though Bo Burnham's a dick, like, I think like the trauma is going to be enough in terms of her revenge on him. I think I wanted to say that Alfred Molina, I think, is fantastic, and I think he's a really important character because he's made like horrible mistakes, but I think it is important that he does show remorse for it compared to other people. So the film does show you that, look, like, there are people in the world who do recognize that they've done wrong, and, you know, they regret that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, because I was very surprised when he turned up, and I think he's actually uncredited in the film, but I think, yeah, his is a really pivotal role. It's the one which throws her off course in the initial sort of plan of getting revenge and stuff. And when she sees that actually someone is actually upset about what they did, it does kind of throw her. But in the end, he's responsible for making sure her final sort of wishes come true. In terms of wishes for Academy Awards, Golden Globes, BAFTAs and stuff like that, you know, it has now been placed as a real contender. You know, won several critic awards, but some people still considered it maybe a bit of an outlier for the main ones, given the sort of subject matter and stuff like that. But, you know, it seems to be doing very, very well. I think the Oscar nominations are actually out tomorrow or Wednesday, I think. So I guess we'll find out then. But do you guys see Oscar gold or awards gold for this promising woman?
Difficult one. Yeah. I don't. To be honest, awards are a sham anyways. Like, I don't really care because, like, they just give it to... Except for Parasite, they always give them to the wrong winners. I can never forgive them for Green Book, Rami Malek, a whole list. So I don't really think it matters that this film gets awards recognition, sorry. But one thing I do want to say is I think it's the same way I feel about, actually, Malcolm and Marie. I think Carey Mulligan and Zendaya both give... like, outstanding performances, and I think it's a real shame that, like, I don't see people talking about those performances online. I see people talking about the discourse being obviously Variety's review of Promising Young Woman and Carey Mulligan, you know, her comment on that. I see people discussing that more than her actual performance. It's the same with the Malcolm Marie discourse. I see people talking about that rather than Zendaya's performance, and I think that's a real shame, because I think both these two women who give fantastic performances, like, they do deserve to be talked about in terms of their performances rather than the issues surrounding it, the discourse.
No, absolutely. It's a really fair point. Malcolm and Marie, I thought, was fantastic, and I thought Zendaya was better than John David Washington. He was good, but I thought Zendaya was on a different level. I mean, like, the last sort of half hour from the scene in the kitchen to, like, the final sort of scenes, she was incredible, and Carey Mulligan is just immense in this. I mean, there's never any doubting her talent. I think ever since I saw her in the Blink episode of Doctor Who was the first thing I ever saw her in, and really wanted her to be the next assistant. But I'm actually glad that it never worked out that way, because she's managed to do some fantastic films. But I think, yeah, no, it's this. There's always a discourse. Everyone needs a discourse to latch on to. But I know when sort of talking about hating things, I always go back to the liberal arts quote, which is shout about what you love, keep quiet about what you hate. And that's what people should do. You know, if you're upset about something...
It's a shame that it's just overshadowing the conversation about their performances, because that should really be the focus. Just unfortunate, but these things happen. But yeah, I suppose, like, even if it was a sham, it would be nice to see Carey Mulligan get something and Emerald Fennel. But I suppose my hope really is that when this film comes out in the UK, whenever it does, currently it's undated, but I feel that, like, I just hope people go and see it. I suppose if it does win awards, it would, like, flag it up to maybe audience members who weren't aware of it. So I suppose I'd hope that it'd win something to encourage more people to see it, because I think it's really, I think it's a masterpiece, and I think it's a really important movie to watch as well that would lead to a lot of important discussion.
Yeah, I'm the same. I can't picture it on Oscar night, it going up. I mean, Parasite is the outlier, I often think, when it comes to the Academy Awards. So unfortunately, I can't see Carey Mulligan getting up there and accepting the awards, or, you know, costumes or cinematography, anything. I don't see it. And I'm the same. I find discourse, you know, so tiresome. It's not the right, you know, I think people get so bogged down in certain aspects, and it's like, but let's talk about the, you know, the film and so on, you know, let's talk about these people and their performances. And yeah, it's you know, it's a shame that, you know, I've seen more people talking about the Variety review and those feelings than, you know, some of the bigger issues that surround Promising Young Woman. And, you know, that's ultimately really disappointing, because there's so much to discuss here. And, you know, I can imagine a few things maybe making or breaking relationships, you know, a film like this, you could imagine in the cinema, I can picture it well, couples going to see it, friends going to see it, and going in expecting one film and coming out with another thing altogether, and then having those discussions, whether it's over Nando's or on the bus home or in the car journey back, or when they've reflected on it. And I worry that with it being on POVOD, sort of in America so far, probably, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the cinemas in the UK. It's not going to be lots of people going to see it. I feel like there's a huge important conversation that could be HUD coming out of the cinema ripped away, and it's going to just happen out on Twitter, and that's never the best place for something like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hope, I mean, Universal have waited this long for it to come out in the UK. And
so I feel that they're waiting, because I think they don't need to show it in UK cinemas just yet anyways for awards recognition, I think, because it's just an American right to enter into awards. So I think they hope that by the time the awards is over, it would have got at least some nominations, then they can release it in cinemas, and that will sort of help. Because I think, like, it's the same with Parasite. I think a lot more people saw Parasite after it won Best Picture. I think, like, yeah, I can't wait to see it in a cinema myself.
Yeah, Parasite, I remember everyone complaining about the fact that they were waiting till February, and everyone in the world had basically seen it in, like, October and stuff, and then it turned out that basically it was released, like, the day after it won, like, Best Picture, and it was like, all right, fair enough, Curzon.
Perfect timing. Yeah, I think that's what they're planning with this.
It is eligible for the BAFTAs. Yeah, it is eligible for the BAFTAs, because they did BAFTA screenings of it, so... And it's on the long list, so I expect it will get shortlisted as well. Personally, I think its best hope is maybe an upset win over Aaron Sorkin in The Trial of Chicago 7 for maybe best original screenplay, something like that. I think, given the likes of Juno and Eternal Sunshine and Spotless Mind, if there's like a quirky independent film which doesn't normally fit in with the traditional Oscar movie, then sometimes it can get the best original screenplay, so perhaps some sort of recognition there would be great. But I think, yeah, it deserves a cinema release, so it does get people talking, because it deals with a really important subject matter in a really interesting and inventive way, and certainly a way that you never are going to expect what's going to come, unless of course you've listened to this spoiler section of the podcast without actually having seen the film yet, and then if so, apologies, but you were warned, so tough luck. So yes, as we've said, at the moment it's undated in the UK. Whether that will be whenever cinemas reopen, whenever that will be, who knows? But you can always check it out on VOD in America. Excellent. And I think we've done a good job of shouting its praises and not getting into too much discourse. When we eventually sort of talk about Malcolm and Marie, I'm sure the discourse for me will basically be about mac and cheese being made from a powdered sauce rather than real cheese. It's not mac and cheese if it's made from a sauce. I know that's what Americans eat, but it's just get a Deliveroo or a Just Eat. I mean, you're famous, you can afford it, you know. Anyway, that's a whole other podcast update. But in the meantime, Emily, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you on, and hopefully we'll be able to get you back on in the future.
Thanks for having me.
And Lee, I'll see you next time, I'm sure. So yeah, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you all soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.